Tell me a little bit about yourself. This is not Gaynor's Passion is not your first book.
No. I guess it's about my eighth. I'm not sure. The numbers go. And as we see them adding up, it becomes a question of the years passing. So the longer list I see, the older I feel.
Well, tell me a little bit about yourself. Where are you from?
I'm one of the few remaining native New Yorkers. Everybody else in New York now is from Des Moines, I find. But I've lived here all my life. Grew up on the island of Manhattan. Swore that if I ever got to be a big boy, I'd move out and live in a private house instead of one of those faceless rabbit warrens they call apartment houses where I grew up. Wanted to have a garage or a basement with a workshop so I could make things not on newspaper on the kitchen floor. So I grew up and had a garage and basement, but no longer wanted to make things. Which means you got to be careful what you want when you're 13. You're liable to end up with them at 40.
That's true. Well, where'd you go to school?
New York, CCNY, mm-hmm. Academy of Fine Art. I became an artist.
That's right. Your publicist said they were going to send me some biographical data about you, yeah. but it never arrived out of the little publicity blurbs here, so I didn't have very much background about you. Yeah. So you initially started out being an artist,
yes,
and you still are.
A professional artist, I still am, but I'm writing now at 95% of the time. I was one of the peculiar positions of supporting my writing habit by painting. Most painters have to do something else to support themselves there. But I was essentially a portrait painter, which at least is accepted and pays a living wage when you're lucky enough to do them.
It's no coincidence, then, that your hero, Gaynor, is a painter.
That's right. And a couple of other books, The Artist, there's always artwork in there someplace. There are areas that you know when you're a professional that no one can know just from casually on the outside. But I switched over. Well, I guess I've been writing for years. I guess my first story was sold to Sad Evening Post way back around 1962 or 3. My first novel was in 1967 or so. And it wasn't until about 8 or 9 years ago when the skies opened up a little bit and I was able to do nothing other than write, if that's what I wanted to do.
Now, did you study art at CCNY?
No. I went to the Academy of Fine Art. I studied briefly in Paris.
The Academy of Fine Arts in New York?
In New York, yeah.
Uh-huh.
People frequently say, did you study to become an artist? But I have a friend who's a brain surgeon. We go to places together. They never ask Tom if he studied to become a brain surgeon. The assumption being is your right hand to God, you say, I am an artist. And judging from some of the non-objective nonsense that's around these days, you can believe it.
Did your friend Tom study to be a brain surgeon?
No. He just did it on weekends until he became good enough.
So you went to Paris, you studied here in New York to become an artist, and when did the professional artwork begin?
Well, I guess when I became a husband and found myself with the need to support a wife. So that from that point on, I've been painting portraits. And
Now, let's go back now. Did you begin to support yourself as an artist from
the very beginning, which is not an easy thing, but somehow I managed.
It's a very unusual job,
isn't it? Yeah. But it was a rare combination of things. I was essentially a portrait painter, but none of my friends were rich enough to afford portraits, so I went to a few of the society columnists way back a few years ago, and I said, I want to know some people who are in the social register but don't want to go to work but would like to earn some money. And I got a couple of names, and they represented me on the basis of I would do their portraits for nothing. They would throw a cocktail party and invite their friends, and they got 25% of every commission I got through them. So after a while, I painted a Vanderbilt, a DuPont, and a Whitney. I ended up painting several presidents on the basis of not hiding my light under the traditional bushel. I did not want to starve. I studied long and hard to become an artist. I loved being an artist, but I saw no reason why I should earn less than the garbage collectors of New York City.
So you became a businessman as well, and you knew how to go about selling yourself in order to do the work that you love.
No one was going to do it for me. I found that out all the way through. I entered the arts, I guess, because I don't want to be that dependent on a job. I never had a job. to those who say, my wife enjoys saying, there hasn't been a Garbo gainfully employed in 200 years.
Tell me about the portraits of the presidents.
Do you really want to hear all about this? I have put all that behind me, and I don't want to get, in the limited time we have, too much involved in that. I want to talk about Gaynor's passion and my writing, if possible.
I do want to talk about that, but finding a little bit about you helps me to understand the way you work as a writer.
Well, I gave up painting because I didn't get the kind of emotional involvement as I got from reading a book. I could read a book and get so immersed in the people, the situation, that I carry the mood around with me for weeks. I would walk through museums, look at the masterpiece of the world, be moved in touch for a moment, and briefly pass by. I don't believe that the easel painter today has a significant part of 20th century living. There's a time when Goya can move the Spanish to revolution. Daumier can cause social reform. Today, when a painting is successful, it hangs in the marble halls of a mausoleum, which is a museum, and people pass briefly by. I'm hotly involved in the passions of the time in which I live, and there's no way that a painting can move people as one book could move, so I switched to writing. Mm-hmm. I'm impatient, frankly, with the art world altogether.
It's very well put. You have not completely abandoned painting.
No, I still keep one painting going, but I do because I enjoy it. But whatever time I've got left, I want to spend as much of it writing. I almost resent coming into New York today to be here with you because it's going to cost me 3 pages.
Yeah, I can understand that. As an amateur writer and dabbling myself, I can understand how you feel about that. Your first novel, tell me, that followed the stories that you sold in the Saturday Evening Post. Tell me about that first novel. What was it called?
That one was Confrontation. I wrote it with Howard Goodkind. And it was a fictionalized version of the Hiss Chambers case. Everything about the Hiss Chambers case is pretty much reversed, but this was the inspiration for it.
Mm-hmm. This was unusual, having a collaborator.
Yeah. He was a friend. He was formerly an editor at Doubleday and Encyclopedia Britannica, Julian Messner. And we discussed the idea together. But that was the only book I ever wrote with anyone. My ego wouldn't stand for his name being the book jacket with mine. And there were things I disagreed with that we couldn't work out and had to compromise on. And since writing is essentially a very personal outpouring, this seemed like rather a ridiculous way to do it, so that was the end of that.
You're still friends?
Yes, we still see one another.
It's not the case with Arnaud de Borchgraf, who's the editor of the Washington Times now, and what's the other guy's name? I can't think of his name. I just interviewed him, too. But he and Robert Moss, they wrote a book together called The Spike. I don't know if you remember that. It's a thriller.
I remember the title. Yeah, I never read it.
I think they wrote a second one together, and then they had a horrible split. I didn't find this out until after I had interviewed Robert Moss recently. And they're politically apart. Mm-hmm. Moss is liberal, and de Borchgraf is very conservative in support of Reagan, and I understand they've been saying terrible things about each other, so I'm delighted to hear that this collaboration of yours does not end in the rupture of your friendship.
No, Howard and I still see one another once every 3 or 4 years, probably. He lives up in Litchfield, Connecticut. We don't get together that often.
That's why it works out.
Yes.
So this worked out so well, this collaboration, although you didn't repeat it, you decided to forge ahead as an independent. Huh?
That's essentially it.
Tell me what happened next.
Well, the next book was The Movement, which came out about 7 months before Kent State, and it dealt with a revolution on campus in which students were shot dead by American troops. And it was reviewed in the Times by John Leonard, who said, very exciting and very prophetic and very frightening, Mr. Garbo, but you really expect us to believe that students will one day be shot dead on an American campus? This is stretching our credibility a bit. Of course, 6 months later, there was Kent State. And so far as I know, John Leonard didn't need his words.
Mm-hmm. John Leonard, huh?
John Leonard.
Okay. In Gaynor's Passion, you deal with a great number of topical themes. Has this been the history of your writing, to find things that have happened in the news and You then take a fictional approach?
Well, essentially, Gaynor's passion, there is a certain type of vigilante approach to justice. Bernhard Goetz's case came into existence about 6 months after I was finished with the book, so I'm not following the news in this case. It's just that there's nothing in the world that gets me more angry, more worked up, than looking at some of the random violence that takes place in the world, watching the 6 o'clock news on television or listening to it on CBS, and finding myself wanting to bang my head against the wall in a sense of futility, where someone will be accosted by a so-called mugger. Give me your money. He gives him the money, and the mugger says, it happened a couple of years ago, I don't like your face, and sticks a dagger into his chest and kills him for no better reason than that. Or some years back, a professor from Columbia University, a survivor of the death camps, walking near 116th Street, someone asked him for money. He didn't give it to him, a kid, quickly enough, and he ended up bleeding to death in the gutter. And this is the kind of stuff that makes me want to scream through the halls of madness. And in most cases, I find that 3/4 of the crimes being committed today are committed by repeat offenders 2, 3, and 4 times. And I find myself over the last 7 or 8 years getting into fights with all my liberal friends who are still fighting strongly for what they feel is the civil rights of individuals when they know they can't walk on the streets, and then the single major instance of fear and involvement is that you cannot walk on the streets. And I find myself lining up with the law and order crowd, which I never was. I still don't consider myself in the sense in which it's used. Law and order, dismissed. You're a hard hat. You're a state Republican. You're anti-minority, which is all nonsense. I grew up in New York City. There wasn't a time when you couldn't walk on the streets any place at any hour of the day or nights. Now, it's impossible.
Well, how did you get here if you couldn't walk on the streets?
At one time. I'm talking about what takes place after a certain hour in certain sections of the city. This essentially is it. Well, the Bernhard Goetz case is a magnificent case in point, you see.
Yeah, I find that that is really unusual, because here you have your hero, Gaynor, a painter who suffers a great tragedy in the airplane crash that kills his two twin boys, who somehow feels a terrific amount of remorse and goes out to become a vigilante. He calls himself the Apostle. Using a mask of one of his boys. And there are so many similarities to the Bernhard Goetz case. I could have sworn you must have written this after Bernhard Goetz. It's really incredible.
Oh, well, it took place, actually I started about 2 years before Bernhard Goetz came to the public consciousness. What Goetz has done is touch a nerve, which is significant in the fact that I've never seen a situation where so many people are so involved emotionally. You cannot go to a party. You can't get together with the friends while this has been going on, where there wasn't a pro and con. The response to this has been enormous. The fact that my passion is involved in Gaynor's passion. I don't write about anything unless I feel the concept deeply. I believe in an emotional moment in what I do. I try to get my readers emotionally involved. I want them to care about my protagonist and my protagonist's feeling, my protagonist's problems. I feel if I can get them to identify with that, I can convince them of anything emotionally, I mean intellectually, where the reverse is not necessarily true. You can take a staid intellectual approach to a concept, be very reasonable, and they still don't give a darn about what the guy is doing or care about him. You make them care in their chest, in their heart, and they'll care with their head, I feel, finally. You can convince them. You can't convince the heart through the head. In the same way that I've always believed that you do not love someone because they're admirable people. You love someone because the way they make you feel, they make you feel lovable and admirable. So it's a peculiar thing. Discussing love, I found, I said, well, love is a very unselfish thing. No, love is one of the more selfish emotions. I love you because you make me feel marvelous when I'm with you. you start making me feel less marvelous when I am with you, I will love you a little bit less. I may even avoid you.
You go. We talked about the topicality of your work a moment ago, but you go further. You have introduced an anti-Semitic right-wing minister, and there are all sorts of Israeli overtones, or spying, this sort of thing. You've also done something else that I thought was unusual. You created a character in the police officer, the lieutenant whose name escapes me.
Jay Newman.
Newman. An alcoholic Jewish policeman? I mean, an Irish alcoholic police officer, but a Jewish alcoholic?
The Jews are becoming so well assimilated, we have our own drunks there, too. And it's astonishing. I've spoken to a few rabbis who tell me there are far more Jewish alcoholics than is admitted publicly. Just that the Jews rarely get drunk in bars. They get drunk more quietly at home.
Having too many seders.
On sweet wine is almost impossible to get drunk.
That's true. Nobody drinks it, actually. Just kind of look at it, you know, sip it, put it down, and yeah, that's it. But that was a nice characterization. It was an unusual one. Are you going to stick to the topicality? Well, go back a little bit. Some of the other books that you've written, have you also used these topical themes?
Well, I believe in a strong narrative drive. For example, of the group that came in the last 6 or 7 years. The first was The Artist, which involved an artist of the stature that Hemingway was to writing, involved in the current events, involved in war, involved in the things that occupy his time. An immigrant boy who came over here as a child and came up that way. And that spanned a great many years. After that came Cabal. Cabal represented an international Jewish conspiracy to help the survival of the Jewish people after 2,000 years of anti-Semitism and the Holocaust, whereby after World War II, a group of men got together and said, since there's been anti-Semitism for 2,000 years and the Holocaust almost finishes completely, we have to be the most utter fools not to start doing something to protect ourselves and not let it happen again. For years, theoretically, the Jews have been accused of an international conspiracy. So here, they actually created one fictionally. And it culminated in the Six-Day War, in which Israel won, really, in the first few hours, when they destroyed the Egyptian Air Force on the ground. And the reviews of that said, there's a tendency here in reading Cabal to wonder, did it really happen this way? So there was a topicality there. After that came a book called Spy, which dealt with five people who met in a facility for plastic surgery, each of them there for a different reason. An executive wanted to be younger, a young actress wanting a nose done, an accident victim, a prize fighter after 16 years in a ring fixing up his face, and an ex-intelligent agent who had just left the service and felt he had to preserve his life by changing his identity. And I wanted to see, essentially, there how their lives were affected by a physical change 1 year later. I couldn't figure out how to get them together 1 year later. And the spy, the ex-spy, took over the book. They were looking for him. And the only four other people who knew what he looked like with his new face were these people. They responded under pressure. I didn't intend to write a book about a spy, but he took it over inadvertently.
What do you like to write? Are you a fan of the thriller genre yourself?
I always hate the word thriller because one tends to dismiss it as just an exciting thing without essentially characterization, without depth of philosophical concept, without all the things, quote, which literature is based upon. I use it as a device because I believe I rather see people in crisis situations, have them respond to the significant things like love, courage, death, fear, whatever, under these situations, rather than, of course, so most of our lives are rather humdrum for 98.7% of the time. There's a small percent in which we're thrown into a crisis. I want to see my people in a crisis and let them reveal themselves this way in all the significant areas.
Well, Norman Garbo, I'm not going to give away the ending of the book on the air, but I would like to ask you a personal question. With Gaynor now under an assumed identity out in California, right? Did he go out to California?
Gaynor, no, Gaynor continues to exist.
No, wait, it's Newman.
It was Newman.
That's right, because he was the one who actually fired the...
That's right.
That's right. Gaynor gets off. That's right. I won't ask that question, and I'll withdraw it. Tell me how you have your office set up and how you approach the craft of writing.
I approach it early in the morning when I drive my wife to work at the Long Island Railroad Station. She goes to New York. I go back, read the Times, and then go right to work. And I work right through it until I pick her up in the evening. There's nothing I'd rather do than write. My friends call me to play tennis. Come on, Norm, give yourself a break. Come out early to play tennis. I said, you don't understand, Charlie. I'd rather write than play tennis. I'll play tennis after a certain hour. But I'm a victim of the Puritan work ethic. I'm a time miser of the worst sort. And I don't know why I keep saying this. You're so darn foolish. You're not going to make a ripple, really, anywhere. But I guess maybe it was Gandhi who said that we're all really unnecessary, but we've got to keep trying to do something.
You always have a project in the works?
I always have a book I'm working on. I'm about 340 pages into the next one after Gaynor's Passion. I finished with Gaynor's Passion last August.
Yeah. It's incredible how far ahead you have to be, isn't it?
About 9 months is like having a child.
Well, I guess a book is a child, isn't it?
Except it's not in my belly. It's in the publisher's belly after I get rid of it.
Well, I certainly enjoyed reading it. I read it some weeks ago, and I read the advanced reading copy, mm-hmm. which there were a number of typographical errors, which I assume are out of the finished book, which I just got this, I think I got it on Monday.
Really?
Or Friday, or just got this, came in for some reason.
I hope that they corrected them there.
You haven't looked?
I haven't looked. I practically never read a book once it's in hardcover that I've written. But that time into the next, and sometimes I almost have to think back, who are these people, because I'm involved with an entire different...
Does it feel, as you look it over, you hardly ever do it, but as you look it over, does it feel like you have actually written this yourself?
Every once in a while I read a passage, at the end, the beginning, and if it's a good feeling, you say, hey, that's not bad, and I feel good about it. If it's not such a good passage, I try and skim over it very quickly. But by and large, I do so much editing when I write that... three or four times around, that most of the stuff that offends me I will have cut out by then. Or if I haven't, my editor may have.
Do you remember pretty well everything you've written and the characters and the plot?
If I talk about it now as I do with you, it comes back.
I was talking to William Manchester a while back, and he had written a memoir, kind of a fictionalized memoir, and apparently he changed all the names.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him about a scene, and I cited a specific character, and he looked at me blankly. And he said, no, there's no character like that. And then, that never happened in the book. So I flipped through the book, and I said, here, I began reading it. That's right. Oh, yeah, I remember now. And it's just funny that he did not remember this character, and he didn't remember the scene in his own book.
It could happen, but when you've written a number of books over a period of 10, 15, 20 years, you can't possibly. You do have to protect yourself against. Sometimes I find myself writing a scene, and I'll write a passage which seems vaguely familiar, and it comes easily. And after all, I found I've written almost the same thing maybe 7 or 8 years ago in another book. Mm-hmm. Because it's subliminally there, mm-hmm. and you find yourself in the same situation with the same possible type of dialogue going on. I find you slip into a groove too easily. I tend to suspect it.
Are you able to pirate any of the material in any of your early work and use it in a current project?
No, I wouldn't even try. I would avoid it if I found myself doing it. Oh, my God, that's like cannibalizing yourself.
Well, a lot of people do. Did you ever read those... I think it's a book called The Notebooks of F. Scott Fitzgerald.
No.
Well, I've seen it. Sometimes you see it. It's a really strange book. It's not for the average person to read. But apparently Fitzgerald saved every scrap, every line he ever wrote on a piece of paper, and they put it all together, and he just would draw on it. I mean, he would draw everything. He just saved everything, and things that he had to cut out of a story or a book he would save and he would use somewhere else, and he never wasted a word. And so every word he ever wrote, he saved somehow and tried to make use of it at a later time. It's not for everybody, but that's what he did.
I'm not a note taker. I'm not a picture taker either. When we travel, I try and look at it. Remember, I find too many people going through the world, looking through here and missing everything while they're looking through their lens. No one wants to look at the bloody pictures afterwards anyway.
Well, Norman Garbo, I know you're chomping at the bit to get back on the Long Island Railroad, head back to home, and have that game of tennis. Since I've ruined your day, you might as well have it. You're not going to start in the middle.
Not ruined. Really, there's nothing I'd rather do than talk about something that is an integral part of me, that I spent a couple of years with, and that I believe in. I'm grateful for the opportunity.
Well, you're an engaging guy, and I know that if we didn't have the time factor, we could probably sit here and talk all day about writing and books. I appreciate your spending the time coming in and talking to me. I look forward to putting this together.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks.